Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Toronto author Terence Green built his novel Shadow of Ashland out of an earlier short story called Ashland, Kentucky. The plot remains pretty much the same, but Green has done a fine job of deepening the characters and exploring personal loss. The story begins in Toronto in 1984, where Leo Nolan's mother's dying wish is to see her brother Jack again. Jack disappeared 50 years earlier, after going to the U.S. After Leo's mother dies, letters from Jack begin to arrive, but they're dated 1934. Intrigued, Leo follows the letters to Ashland, Kentucky. There, he checks into the Scott Hotel, Jack's last known address. Late one night, Leo meets a young man on the street, and as they talk, Leo realizes that this is his Uncle Jack, and that somehow the calendar has jumped back to 1934. Here's Michael Hogan with Episode 6 of Shadow of Ashland.
Everything changed. The temperature had dropped slightly, the wind was gone, and the approaching storm had ceased to exist. The street lamps were cast iron, with gracefully arched necks, their bulbs suspended downward. And in that soft light, I began to note the hulking black coupes of the 1930s parked intermittently about the street. Then I turned and stared in the opposite direction, my eyes catching the announcement for King Kong starring Fay Wray and Bruce Cabot, jutting over the sidewalk below the green marquee of the Paramount Theater. I glanced in a window beside me, a clothing store. Ayers all-wool tweed coat, $9.75, delivered. Ladies high-fashion dress, $2.98, delivered. Black catfish or white leather pump featuring a smart new bow, $2.45 pair, delivered. I stood on Winchester Avenue in Ashland, Kentucky, and let it happen. "Where are you staying?" Jack asked. I shrugged. "You really on vacation?" There was a playfulness to his question. I thought of Jean. The story had an obvious timelessness to its incredibility. "Sort of," I said. "Yeah," he said, "like everybody else." He took a package of cigarettes from his pants pocket, shook one loose, placed it between his lips, then held the package out toward me. "No thanks." He smiled, put them away. He lit his own, inhaling the smoke, enjoying the luxury. Then he seemed to study me. "How do you know it was me?" "I've seen pictures," I lied. "Of Margaret and you." He smiled again, his pleasure obvious. "Where do you know Marg from? I thought I knew all her friends." "You've been gone a while now," he nodded. "That's true." "Marg helped my family when we moved into the neighborhood." I began to amaze myself with my story. "Helped me look after my father." "How's Tommy?" he asked, watching me. "He's in good shape, still working. And the kids?" "Ronnie and Ann?" I smiled. "Healthy as horses." He relaxed even more. "So you live up around Young and Eglinton, do you?" I nodded. "Too far north of the city for my tastes. I guess I'm kind of a downtown kid." He nodded in the direction of the railway lines just this side of the river. "You sleeping down there?" I followed his gaze and took my cue. "Isn't everybody?" He seemed to consider. The cigarette smoke floated upward in the still air. "I'm not sure what you're doing, Leo, but any friend of Marg's a friend of mine. It's as simple as that," he pondered. "Maybe I can help you." I waited. "I know a nice place. I think we can work something out." I followed his glance. The Scott Hotel in its prime, even in the dark, was a very nice place. We slipped into the Scott, up the stairs and into room 8 on the third floor. Jack's things were spread throughout the room. Mine were gone. He pulled a pillow and a blanket from the bed, the same white-painted iron bedstead that I had known, and tossed them on the floor by the window. "Good enough?" he asked. "It'll do fine," I said. I went over to the window, looked out. The church was still there. Then I sat down on the floor with my back against the wall, staring at him. He smiled, dropped back onto the bed, ran his hands through his dark, curly hair. "What?" he asked. "How do you know you can trust me?" I frowned. "How do you know who I am?" He continued to smile that magic, disarming smile, his eyes burning with a belief in a future. "A hunch," he said. "And you're a friend of Marg's. It's enough." He pulled off a shoe and leaned back on his elbow, gazing at me. "You must know that she makes everyone a better person just because she believes in them." His eyes twinkled. "You know what I mean?" "Yes," I said. It was true. "In the morning," he said, "we'll talk." He turned off the light. In the darkness, I could see the tip of his cigarette flare when he inhaled, smell its smoke as it wended its way out the window by my side. When it was dashed out, I must have slept, or dreamed that I slept. I woke with the sunlight streaming in above me. I was still on the floor. Jack was still in the bed. He pushed up onto an elbow when he heard me stir and smiled. I touched the wall beside me. It was solid. It was real. I looked for my car at the back of the Scott when we were outside. It was gone. "Where are we going?" I asked. He went ahead of me across Winchester Avenue. "Get something to eat." "Where?" We reached the other side and stopped. "Soup kitchen," he looked at me, "unless you got some money." I reached into my pants pocket and took out my wallet. I opened it and looked in. It was empty. We sat at a plank table in a warehouse near the east end of town. Dozens of men at similar tables surrounded us. The room was lit by bare light bulbs hanging from wiring strung over thick wooden rafters. With a twisted fork and knife in my hands, I stared at the rough metal plate. Jack was eating. He caught me studying the food in front of me, sat back and watched. "Ever eaten one of these places before?" I shook my head. "No." He continued chewing, thinking. "You got no money, you'll get used to it." There was little conversation anywhere about us. The sounds of metal against metal pervaded in its stead. Everyone had the same meal. White beans boiled in water, two slices of dry bread, and a cup of tea. I sampled the beans. They were almost completely tasteless. "Is it always the same food?" Jack nodded as he ate. "Mostly," he swallowed. "Sometimes you get porridge in the morning. Not too often, though," he smiled. "Once, though, a local guy shot a bear, donated it. Everybody had diarrhea for 48 hours. He shrugged. "Poor bloody bear." Around noon, we walked through the railway yards by the river. On the far side of the tracks, we stood high up over the Ohio, looking down on the stony strand. Smoke drifted up through the leaves of a sycamore tree from three different campfires. A dozen or so men idled about. I watched the trail of the campfire smoke adrift in the afternoon haze. "What are they cooking?" Jack shrugged. "Gophers, squirrels, possums, whatever they can catch." I didn't know what to say. "Could be worse." I looked at him. "Could be a bear." He grinned boyishly. But in his eyes I saw something I tried to put my finger on, something that eluded description. I think it was sadness. Later that afternoon we sat on the porch swing on the front veranda of the Scott Hotel. "You're doing okay, though, aren't you, Jack? A job? Place to live? Why eat in the soup kitchens?" He grimaced, bared his teeth, which were a startling white, while he reflected. Then he said, "I got nothing. Job barely keeps me alive. Eating there most of the time is a way of staying even." He paused. "I treat myself sometimes. A meal, a hot dog from a restaurant, a movie, cigarettes, but not much." His eyes were crinkled at the corners from the glare, from thinking, from the truth. I saw the Paramount Marquee for King Kong again and recalled the letter of September 30th that my father had read over the phone. "What's today's date?" I asked. "It's the 8th. Of October?" He nodded. I gestured toward the theater. "You seen that one yet?" "Saw it the other night." I fell quiet. "Sad," he said. "The ape gets a raw deal." "Margaret read me some of your letters." He looked at me with a combination of bemusement and surprise. "She thinks you're doing okay. Mentioned a car, clothes, job as a photographer with a Detroit firm." He bowed his head, smiling meekly. I watched him. "It's not true, is it?" He looked me in the eye. "No," he said. The word was very soft. I nodded, understanding. We were both quiet for a long time. "Some people still live real good," he said. "Bankers, lawyers, the ones that feed on the rest, inherited money, you know?" I put my hands in my pockets, leaned my head back, and stared into the endless blue sky. But it's like a giant iceberg, just the tip is showing. Most of it's just gliding along, out of sight, massive. He paused. Dangerous. He said the last word carefully, nodding to himself, then lit a cigarette. The screen door swung open and a young man of about 30 strode out. Jack, he said, how you doing? He put his hands on his hips. Jack greeted him with a smile. Good, he said. The newcomer was about 5'9", strongly built, the arms showing from his t-shirt, well-muscled and tanned. His hair was sandy blonde, slicked back straight. He glanced at me, his eyes narrowing. Jack picked up the cue. Leo, he touched my arm, like you to meet the man who owns the hotel. I saw who he was in the same moment that I heard his name, Stanley Matusik. I saw the line toughness that was to come, the tufts of white hair that would be left. And as he extended his hand toward me, the future calluses on his 80-year-old skin just beginning. He squeezed my hand warmly. Pleased to meet you. My pleasure, I managed to say, unable to take my eyes from him. Leo's from Toronto, said Jack. Stanley's eyebrows rose. Really? Friend of my sister. You working, Leo? Stanley Matusik asked. No, I said, I'm not. I went for the simplest answer. Figures, he said. Wasn't for Teresa's parents, we wouldn't have nothing either. They set us up with this place. He paused. Teresa works at Woolworths, makes $11 a week. Rockefeller paid $6 million in tax alone. Something's definitely screwed up, wouldn't you say? It didn't need an answer. Willie's plan in Toledo dropped from 28,000 workers to 4,000. Hung on for a while, then went bust. Unemployment in Cincinnati's over 20%, and another 20% is employed only part-time. More than 1,000 homes a day in this country are being taken over by mortgage holders. He looked at me and half-smiled. I guess you could say that it all obsesses me. He nodded. Yes, indeed, he said. You could surely say that. Stanley's eyes focused on two men coming up the street. Then he looked at me. Got some things to tend to. He shook my hand again. Nice meeting you, Leo. He looked at Jack. If Jack thinks you're a good man, maybe we can talk some more. Some of us got plans, haven't we, Jack? You bet. Stanley looked at the sky. Gonna rain the next few days. Can feel it. His face wrinkled. Not good, not good at all. I didn't understand why the rain was so bad, but I didn't ask. I'd understand soon enough. Afternoon, Stan, Jack. The two men in overalls and work boots nodded abruptly to us, then proceeded inside the Scott Hotel. Jack and Stanley's eyes flickered momentarily to one another, then dropped. A moment later, I found them studying me. Through the screen door, I could hear the fading footsteps of the two men as they descended stairs into the basement. Stanley broke the silence. Gotta go. He reached out his hand again. Nice meeting you, Leo. I shook it. Talk to you later, Jack. He looked at me. Maybe you too. Hope so, I said. He turned and went inside, following the men downstairs. I followed Jack into the Woolworths on Winchester where Jean worked. The place, new and shiny. Jean wasn't there. My eyes scanned glass jars of Baby Ruth bars, cookies, and stick candy as we strode through the aisles. A BB air rifle was 79 cents. A leather basketball, $1. And I stopped for a second to touch a baseball glove with the ball, sold as a package for $1.25, thinking of Jean and Adam. We sat at the dinette counter on the red and chrome swivel chairs, and I stared unabashedly at the sight of an achingly pretty young Teresa Matusik, who materialized suddenly amid the collage of signs and prices and soda treats arrayed behind her. Her hair, I thought, was beautiful. I looked at Jack, then back at her, and I remembered that it had been done in a beauty parlor. Leo, this is Teresa. She wiped her hand on the white apron, then placed it in mine. Pleased to meet you. I found my voice. Hi, Teresa. I tried, rather unsuccessfully, not to stare. Her face crinkled. Not from around here, are you? I shook my head. Toronto, like Jack. Can tell from your accent. North somewhere. Leo's a friend of my sister, Marg. Might stay a bit. Ah, she seemed to understand something. What it was, I wasn't sure. Depends, I said. Do you think Barbara could spare us a sandwich? Asked Jack. Keep body and soul together? She smiled at him. See what she can do. She moved off down the counter. When she was rummaging in a loaf of white bread, I asked, "Who's Barbara?" He grinned. "Hotton, Woolworth heiress. Poor little rich girl, who else?" He turned to me, speaking under his breath. "I figure Barbara can afford to treat me to the occasional sandwich. You too. Nobody's hurt." He glanced down the counter, smiling that startling smile at Teresa, who smiled back. "Only reason I come here," he said. His last sentence settled like a door clicking solidly shut. Yet glancing from one to the other of them, watching what passed between them, I saw, with wonder and trepidation, that there was clearly another reason why he came here. That night, Jack went to work at the hospital and left me alone in his room. It wasn't until sometime after midnight that the noises coming from the basement began to infiltrate my consciousness. I listened. Opening the door, I stood on the third floor landing. Muffled voices. A pause. Hammering. Silence. I descended the stairs. As on the journey into the past, I was being drawn down, led beneath the apparent schematics of things into the subterranean world of some dark truth. On the second floor landing, I stood and listened again. Voices. Quiet. Then voices. Hammering. Quiet. I waited another minute. A bit of soft laughter rolled up the stairs. Then more talking. The sound of a shovel scraping dirt from a cement surface. I continued downward. "Jack," I thought. "Jack, are you down there?"
Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, Leo joins a dangerous plot to make a pile of money. There's more magic at work in our poetry nightcap, but it's got nothing to do with time travel. The spell is cast by the season in May Sarton's poem, December Moon. It's read by Patricia Hamilton.
December Moon. Before going to bed, after a fall of snow, I look out on the field, shining there in the moonlight, so calm, untouched and white. Snow silence fills my head after I leave the window. Hours later, near dawn, when I look down again, the whole landscape has changed. The perfect surface gone, crisscrossed and written on where the wild creatures ranged while the moon rose and shone. Why did my dog not bark? Why did I hear no sound there on the snow-locked ground in the tumultuous dark? How much can come, how much can go, when the December moon is bright? What worlds of play we'll never know, sleeping away the cold white night after a fall of snow.
May Sarton's poem, December Moon, read by Patricia Hamilton. It's from the late American poet's collection, Coming into 80, published by W.W. Norton. That's our program for this evening, but before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available through Goose Lane Editions. Selected readings from past seasons of the program are available on CD or on cassette. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-9-COVERS. That's 1-888-926-8377. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and then it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.